Excellent. Thank you, Kyle. Good afternoon. I'd like to reconvene the recessed meeting of the Property and Local Tax Division of the Minnesota House. First bill on the agenda is House File 174. Representative Allen, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Representative Allen, Representative Mahoney moves that House File 174 be before the committee and held over for possible inclusion in the division report. Thank you, Representative Mahoney.
My pleasure, Mr. Chair.
Representative Mahoney, would you like to move the H0174A1 amendment as well?
Yes.
Thank you, Representative Mahoney. Representative Allen, this is your amendment to get the bill in the form which you prefer. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
All right. All those in favor of the A1 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Allen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Welcome to your bill.
This is an exemption for property that the Minnesota Chippewa Tribe owns in Minneapolis, and to provide some property tax relief. Minnesota Chippewa Tribe is the governing body of the Chippewa tribes. They have a constitution, and our testifiers can tell you a little bit more about the MCT, which was so this property is located at 1308 Franklin Avenue, and that's in Karen Clark's district, Representative Clark's district. This is a very limited bill. We're aware in Minneapolis of only one property where the tribe actually owns the property. So this is relief from a tax that is a tax on the land, and that it will be the use of the property is currently it is being used for governmental activities, governmental purposes, non-commercial, and this exemption would not categorically not apply to commercial enterprise or commercial type activities. So, and I'll turn it over to testifier Ms. Van Norman to talk about that.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Sarah Van Norman. I am from the law firm of Jacobson, Buffalo, Magnuson, Anderson, and Hogan in St. Paul here, and I represent Jacobson, Buffalo is fine, too, for those who are giving me, oh, that's an earful kind of looks. I represent the Minnesota Chippewa Tribe in this manner, or the MCT. As Representative Allen said, the MCT property is just about the only property of this particular kind that we've been able to find on a diligent review in the state, actually, which is an off-reservation, tribally owned property used exclusively for governmental services or for housing 501c3s that provide services to tribal members and others in their neighborhoods. I believe you've received handouts in your packets, the particular entities that are there include not only the urban offices of various member bands of the MTC, MCT, like White Earth, Fond du Lac, and Boys Fort's council representative offices, but the Minnesota American Indian Chamber of Commerce, Wakoye Nandakindin Dakota and Ojibwe Immersion School, Immersion Program, which exposes children to language services, and a couple of other entities like that. Our argument is very simple. This property is a public property used for a public purpose. It just doesn't happen to be a state subdivision. It is a tribal public property. And so we've tried to craft language that will very narrowly bring this type of property or this particular property into the policy that we already have in the state in terms of exemptions for these properties. We are continuing to work with the assessors and others, as we have for more than a year now, to reach appropriate language that will make it clear how narrow the exemption we're seeking really is, and that it is solely for purposes that there would be no question are public in any other context.
All right. Thank you very much. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And
testifier. Is it this? We're talking the project down there, the apartment complex, or are we talking other buildings down there?
Ms. Van Norman.
Franklin and Bloomington, I think it is, or Cedar?
Representative Nelson, it's actually right adjacent to that property. This is its own building, the Minnesota Chippewa Tribes building. If you drive down Franklin, it is about kitty corner from the ancient traders market. Okay. Very close there, just down from the All My Relations Gallery, if anyone is familiar with Franklin Avenue's native corridor businesses.
So, Mr. Chair,
Representative Nelson,
it does not include the housing area that's down there, or does that include the housing area?
Ms. Van Norman.
It does not.
Okay, thank you. That's all.
All right. Do you have other testifiers? All right.
No, Mr. Chair.
All right. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Council, is this setting a precedent? Do we do this?
He's pausing. Mr. Hines? Mr. Biggerstaff?
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, Mr. Biggerstaff may want to jump in on this too. You know, generally speaking, tribal lands held in trust are all exempt. So that's kind of the first thing to realize that if it was held in trust, it would be exempt. So it's not falling under that exemption, which normally applies. There is an exemption for institutions of purely public charity, and that is a phrase that has been worked over quite a bit by the assessors community in the last three or four years perhaps. And there are a whole set of standards that the assessors apply to determine if something qualifies under that standard. And I think there might have been an allusion that there's some thought that this building might qualify under that, but so far it has not. They have not sort of seen fit to include it under that definition. So I think this is an attempt to go straight to saying let's just exempt this and not subject it to that. But that's about as much as I think I know about the subject.
Representative Erickson, let me step back for a moment. Let's see if there's anyone else in the public who wishes to testify.
Sure.
And then
Surely.
Take member questions, and sure. You'll be tops on the list.
That'd be great.
So, thank you. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify regarding House File 174? And I think that looks like a yes. Good afternoon. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Rob Vanasek, here on behalf of the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers. And I am pinch hitting today with the kind of shorter notice. And I'm going to provide you with some testimony that was given on this bill on behalf of the Hennepin County Assessor, Jim Atchison. First, I'd like to introduce the MAO, Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers, to all the members and explain why we as assessors are not in support of this bill. The Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers is a professional association formed in 1949 of county assessors, city assessors, local assessors from across the state. We are a resource. We provide assistance and expertise in all property tax matters. Our position statement for this session states, we support the production of high-quality annual assessments through uniform and consistent application of best assessment practices. We support the principle of ad valorem taxation. It should be accountable, justifiable with similar properties, understandable and transparent to taxpayers based on a fair and equitable tax base. We think good tax policy treats all taxpayers in a consistent manner, and we oppose classifications or programs that target only a small number of taxpayers. Lands located on Indian reservations and held in trust with the United States are exempt from taxation per Minnesota Statute 272.01. Lands not held in trust with the U.S. are not exempt from taxation per Minnesota Statute 272.01. The lands at issue in this bill fall under the category of not held in trust and are not exempt from taxation. As you're aware, only the county assessor, in the case of Minneapolis as a first-class city, the city assessor, and the Minnesota Tax Court can approve exemptions. As a county assessor, I'm not a county assessor, but here to explain how the facts of the bill would be implemented. These are some concerns. Property located in a city of the first class that is owned by a federally recognized Indian tribe. There are four cities that meet the requirement of the city of first class. Property located in a city of the first class that is owned by a federally recognized Indian tribe within the state of Minnesota and used for tribal purposes is exempt. Tribal purposes includes tribal governmental activities, services to members of the tribe, and sales by or for the benefit of the members of the tribe. Now the amendment did take care of that last piece. On the property located in a class of the city of the first class that is owned by a federally recognized Indian tribe, we'd ask for clarification on the present ownership, as the two parcels that are at the core of this exemption are owned in fee in the name of Minnesota Chippewa Tribe Finance Corporation. We are only aware of these two parcels qualifying. The mission of the Finance Corporation is to finance and promote affordable, safe, and decent housing and economic development opportunities for low and moderate income band members and sustain healthy communities within its service area. The corporation has been administering and providing mortgage loan services to low and moderate American Indian borrowers since 1977. These two parcels are contiguous, both improved with multi-tenant office buildings. Per a 2010 rent roll and a lease from 2011, these different tenants do pay gross rents to the finance corporation, which bought the property in September 2009. So just some concern: if the words first class were removed, any lands across the state then owned by a federally recognized Indian tribe would be exempt. In Scott County alone, approximately 4,400 acres are owned by the Shakopee Mdewakan Sioux community, and only 1,600 acres are held in trust and exempt from taxation. The non-trust balance of 2,800 acres, even though they're owned by the tribe, are under current statute taxable. Bill would add the 90th category of exempt property under Minnesota Statute 272.01. And we would encourage the Finance Corporation to exhaust other avenues for exemption before creating new language. But all that being said, Mr. Chair and members, although we do have some strong reservations about any property tax exemptions, period, we have been speaking with the proponents of the bill and do hope to tighten things down and perhaps get them to where they eventually want to be.
Thank you, Mr. Vanasek, and thank you for continuing to work with the advocates for the bill. Mr. Carlson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Keith Carlson. I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Intercounty Association, among whose members are two counties that potentially would be affected by this bill as they contain first-class cities. Our membership also includes other counties that, without the qualification of first-class cities, such as Scott County, would conceivably also be affected addressing the issue that was raised previous. Would this raise any precedent? I just want to not belabor what's already been stated by Mr. Banasik on behalf of the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers, but to say that we have similar concerns, and I have spoken with the author and also have been speaking with the advocates to come up with mutually agreeable language that would tighten the subject down to just the specific subject property in question.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Thank you, gentlemen. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify regarding House File 174? Going once, going twice. All right. Representative Erickson, as I said, back to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I don't know if counsel was going to continue elaborating on this, but if not, I'll go ahead and...
I thought that Mr. Hines was done, but if he wants to pick up again...
So, Ms. Van Norman, what would prevent tribes from buying land, fee land, and then proceeding to use this exemption, because then suddenly they can argue that it's a nonprofit, or you know, it's for a government outside the usual units of government that follow state law?
Ms. Van Norman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Erickson. In fact, the thing that would prevent it is the plain language of the provision itself. This seems to get to the additional note that we've just seen today, and that we've heard a little bit more about whether there actually are even other properties now that could be covered by this. In the revenue analysis detail that you received in your packets, there's a comment that we hadn't seen before that at least two properties in Minneapolis and nine in Duluth may qualify for this provision. Frankly, that's news to us, and we haven't, in our research and in my firm's representation of many other tribes, including constituent bands who own properties in Duluth, other property tax exemptions may apply to those properties, or there may be no basis for exemption. There are plenty of examples like that where tribes have commercial enterprises, non-gaming commercial enterprises, and they aren't seeking a tax exemption. They're just operating in the same way that any other business owner would. So there really is an attempt to make this very specific to this property that is solely used for precisely the purposes for which it's held out. Now, just like any other public property that is used for a public purpose, if, for example, a state entity had a property and rented it out to somebody who then used it for a commercial purpose, why, it would no longer enjoy the same exemption status. That's by operation of existing law. It's the public purpose that controls. As for some of the other comments that we heard, it continues to be the case that we would support the restriction to the city of the first class justification, not just because of this property itself, but there's some additional basis for that being a principal distinction. We're here to serve the urban Indian community. That's what this property is for. And the Phillips neighborhood is, I'm sure, Representative Allen can attest, is one of the largest urban Indian communities in the United States. It's a very important place, and it's an important property for serving that community.
And Representative Allen.
And I would add that it's approaching about almost 70% of tribal members live off the reservation now, and there's a lot of family. There's going on three generations that may be living in Little Earth, and many of tribal members go back and forth. So you recently there's been a number of tribes that bands that have put offices in the Phillips neighborhood so that they could serve their members and provide governmental services. That and many of those services are unique services where the tribal members have special needs for services.
Thank you. Ms. Van Norman, were you done with your comments in response to Representative Erickson's question?
It certainly was in response. I had another comment in response to the other witnesses, but that was my response, unless Representative Erickson.
I think Representative Erickson has more.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is any one of these services providing, are they for pay? Is there profit that's realized from any of these services? And if there is, to whom does that go? Because then it wouldn't really be a nonprofit.
Ms. Van Norman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson. They all are complying with the provisions of their nonprofit 501c3 status, to my knowledge, just as any other entity that is able to maintain that status over time must. They have to prove that on a regular basis, and they certainly are. The payment of rents, actually, to the MCT, if that's part of what Representative Erickson, you're referring to, doesn't defeat a public purpose or the public status of a property anyway. It's just the question of, it's not characterized in the same way as it is in another kind of more typical retail setting. And the rents go to the MCT Housing Finance Corporation, which is itself an alter ego of the tribe. And the only reason that it exists and has that housing bit in it is because it was set up historically under state nonprofit law in order to enjoy some Minnesota Housing Finance Agency connection and funding. It still exists, and its mission has expanded today solely for purposes of allowing the tribe to do business. There's a reason to have alter egos for tribes to do business and own properties like this based on some of the vagaries of federal Indian law, but it is the tribe itself. It is solely for government support that it exists.
Representative Erickson.
Well, Ms. Van Norman, the Minnesota Chippewa Finance Corporation owns this building, is that correct?
Ms. And Van Norman.
Do they realize a profit from this?
Ms. Van Norman.
Representative Erickson, in the strictest sense, they do not. They receive monies from the business, but they don't, it's not, I'm quite certain that it's only going to paying for the mortgage at this point for the acquisition. But that said, the receipt of money simply goes back into the management of government and provision of government services by the tribe. So only in this, if the state of Minnesota is receiving, they're making money by receiving taxes, that's more the parallel, I would say.
Representative Erickson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we just need to be alert to the fact that this says first class now, but we can always modify and amend law. And I would have to say that, you know, I have constituents who would be very concerned about this. We already have a nonprofit on trust land in Mille Lacs County. They make a profit, and, you know, it's very concerning to a low property tax county like Mille Lacs, whose greatest industry is the casino and all the amenities with it. And we realize no property tax from it. So, you know, I have to speak for my constituents who would be absolutely very, very concerned if this becomes law and then if at some future time first class is deleted and any city is allowed to do this or a tribe can do this in any city. So I just want to express my concerns on behalf of my constituents.
Thank you, Representative Erickson. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and my question might have been for the author, but I'll speak to the attorney here, because at this particular point, if you're reading the papers, one of the nations bought two hotels in downtown St. Paul. So it is, I mean, I understand what the assessors were talking about with the change of language, because that can easily be done. I'm sure there's people in this room that have done it at one point or another. So that is a concern of mine, and I hope you tighten up the language to make sure that, you know, it is just this one particular incidence and one place. I mean, certainly you could do west of the Mississippi and north of the Minnesota would take care of my concerns. Pass that along to, as you negotiate this before it gets to the final committee, I'm sure. Just know that there's concerns out there on that.
Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've had some folks talk to me a little bit about this, and I would like to say that I support this bill along with its amendments. I think it is important to tighten up the language and make sure that tribes are not, you know, acquiring taxable property to eventually make a commercial enterprise of it, such as casinos. So ratcheting down the language to non-commercial, I think, certainly does that. In addition, I would just like to speak to the general purpose or the general good. And in as much as we experience in our own structure and format of government, I think it's appropriate that all tribal governments be able to have a tax-exempt status with regard to their government operations, serving the constituents and the needs of their community. And if we're able to do things to propel that effort and to make serving members of their tribe in terms of it strictly being government and government operations, we ought to be doing that so that it can do that in an efficient manner and be close to the constituents that it's serving. And it certainly makes sense to me, and certainly in the absence of they themselves trying to take care of themselves, I think would fall on the greater responsibility of all Minnesota taxpayers. So if they're able to do something on their own and serve their own, I support that idea.
Thank you, Representative Hertas. Seeing no other questions, Representative Mahoney, if you would renew your motion that House File 174, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in the division report, I'd appreciate it.
You would, sir.
Thank you very much. Ms. Van Norman, thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
Representative Nornes, good to see you. Representative Torkelson, would you like to move House File 81 be before the committee for possible inclusion?
I so move, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Torkelson. Representative Nornes, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, thanks. Glad to be here, and I believe this is the first time in the years I've served where I've actually been in front of your committee.
I believe that's true in the aggregate, first, as it were. Thank you. Somebody got it. All right. Representative Nornes, what do you have for us today?
I appreciate your attitude. It's a very refreshing attitude. What was the motion? I missed that.
The motion is for it to be laid over for possible inclusion in the division report.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. This legislation actually was a part of the tax bill, one of the tax bills last session that was vetoed, so it has kind of been through the process in the past. Also in the past, I've had Mayor Dean Harstick here with me to speak on behalf of his community, but we've had a blizzard up in my part of the state, and he apologizes, but he can't get here. So
understood, Representative Nornes.
I'm a sub. Well, I would be here anyway, I guess.
Because you can't get home either.
Yeah, that's right. So, well, I appreciate the time to hear this legislation. I also have a resolution passed by the council in the city of Vergas, and that was done back in, I believe, October. So if you want to see that, I can show it to you, but I do have it. House File 81 allows the community of Vergas, population 331, to impose an aggregate materials tax to benefit the city of Vergas. And there is a large gravel pit located within the city limits. This gravel pit is not city-owned, but it is privately owned. The city is without any means right now to restore that site once the pit is empty or all of the aggregate has been removed. So this material tax would allow a certain amount of revenue to be earmarked for restoration and reclamation of that land. Reclamation of mined land is important because it has sort of a negative value to the community if you just have a big hole in the ground. So they feel very strongly about being able to, in the future, return it back to a useful purpose. Otter Tail County does not have its own aggregate tax. They could pass one if they chose to, but they choose not to. And so that's the reason that the community of Vergas is here asking for their opportunity to have the tax. It's the second Otter Tail County, I guess, has the distinction of having two requests. Some years ago, Scambler Township had the same request, and that was granted That gravel pit has now been exhausted, by the way, but so this is not the first. There are the uses for the tax would include the reclamation, as I mentioned, but also the gravel trucks go right through the community, some wear and tear on their streets. It would allow some of the money to be used to repair those streets. The tax amounts to 15 cents per ton, and a portion of that, again, can be used for roads and bridges, the rest of it for restoration and environmental needs. That pretty well covers the purpose, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you, Representative Nornes. Is there anyone in the audience wishing to testify regarding House File 81? Good afternoon, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to. My name is Fred Corrigan. I'm executive director of the Aggregate and Ready Mix Association of Minnesota. I'm here today to oppose House File 81, which seeks to authorize the City of Ergas to impose an aggregate production tax. The Aggregate and Ready Mix Association of Minnesota believes the legislative intent of Minnesota's Statute 29875, as proposed by the Aggregate Resources Task Force in the laws of 1998 and revised in 2008, was for this tax to be imposed and collected by counties to ensure a fair and level playing field for aggregate producers in the local marketplace. Most of the aggregate materials being produced in the City of Ergas are currently being shipped to Becker County, where it pays the aggregate tax to Becker County under the import provisions of Minnesota 28.75. Legislative authorization for the City of Ergas to collect the aggregate tax would result in loss of revenue to Becker County, which meets all of the provisions of Minnesota 29875. The aggregate industry believes this is a good example of the legislative intent of this tax being met by aggregate producers in the fact that they are paying the import tax in Becker County. We obviously worry about the precedent. The tax division could be hearing a host of bills in the future, whether a township thinks they should be getting a county share of the money. Current law is sufficient and exemptions aren't necessary or helpful. The city does have the authority to require the property owner to reclaim the property. This property is not owned by the aggregate producer. It's owned by a private landowner who is leasing this property out for aggregate production. Why the city doesn't require reclamation from, which is typical in most contracts with aggregate producers, is beyond us. So we're not very sympathetic, frankly, to the claim that the money should be collected for the purpose of reclamation. The other thing, I'm sorry the mayor wasn't here today, but this bill was up last year. My understanding is that the aggregate producers don't use city streets. So they're going out on county road. They're crossing the county line into Becker County. So I'm not sure what impact this operation has on city streets. So, Mr. Chair, again, we believe that local government of collection of the tax represents a host community fee resulting in distortion of the marketplace, impacting both the public and private sectors who pay this tax. And a host community fee was specifically prohibited in statute in the 2008 revision of the tax. We do not believe the townships or small cities have the resources to properly administer this tax, whereas the county usually has both the resources and, as the permitting authority, the expertise to administer the tax collection and implement the reclamation of the abandoned pits. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Corrigan. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Nornes, was this in the tax bill that I think Representative Davis called the smoking hot tax bill from last year?
No, I believe it's smoking hot.
Smoking hot.
You got to get the inflection right, Representative Nornes.
Representative Nornes, was this in the bill from last year?
Mr. Chair,
Representative Nornes.
Nelson, I do not know which. There were several tax bills, and I'm not sure which one this was in specifically. I just know it was vetoed. There were several maybe that were vetoed, but that's how this ended up last session.
Representative Nelson.
It was traveling along nicely until it's ran into a veto.
Representative Faust.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for the testifier. What is Becker County doing with the money that they're collecting? And am I right in that this gravel pit, I guess is what we always call it, is that right on the county line so that the majority of the trucks aren't driving in the city? They're just going straight into Becker County? And so if you'd clarify those for me, I'd appreciate it.
Mr. Corrigan.
Mr. Chair, Representative, again, I'm sorry the mayor is here today. My understanding is it does go through town on a county road, and that's within 3 or 4 miles from the county line.
Okay. Representative Faust?
Yeah, thank you. So if I understand what you said about that the city can force the landowner to reclaim that. Is that typically what happens, or do the counties typically do that?
Mr. Corrigan?
Mr. Chair, Representative, especially where there's a landowner negotiating with a contractor to mine the property, that's typically in the contract that the contractor, the miner, will usually reclaim the property as they mine across the property. In this situation, I understand Representative Norris to say that this property has been mined for many years, so it's going to be tough to reclaim that property, and I can see why the city and owner are looking for somebody else to pay for this.
Yeah. Representative Faust.
Yeah, again, back to the original question, as far as Becker County using this money to fix the roads that these trucks are driving on, or are they just dumping it into their general fund, or what are they doing with the money?
No, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Corrigan.
Representative, the statute 298.75 is pretty clear that it needs to be used for the portion that goes to the county or to the local government needs to be used for road and bridge, except for the 15%, which goes to environmental.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Corey. Representative Norris, I'm sorry.
I want to respond to that because
certainly
Becker County has a gravel tax, so when the gravel comes into the county, they collect it. Correct. And
for the record, Mr. Corrigan is nodding, yes.
Yeah, okay. I was going to mention, too, that in the city of Burgess, there's only a couple of ways to get through town. And so the trucks can't avoid going through town as they're hauling, and whether they're going east, west, or I'm not sure if a road goes south out of there, actually. But
Mr. Corrigan, could you answer a question for me? If these trucks are paying an import tax when they go into Becker County, and Virgus were to be given the authority to levy this and then did, would the aggregate trucks have to pay a tax to the city of Virgus and an import tax to Becker County, Mr. Corrigan?
Mr. Chair, no. And that provision, I know a number of the members that were involved in that bill a couple of years ago, was designed for a couple of purposes. One, for material that comes in from another state is required to pay the tax coming into Minnesota. And that provision also applies from a county, because this is an opt-in tax from a county that does not collect the tax that's shipping into a tax into a county that does collect it. If you were shipping, Mr. Chair, from a county that does not to a county that does not, there's no tax.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Corrigan. Representative Faust, you wanted another question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Great minds travel in the same circles, and you asked exactly the same question I was going to ask.
Thank you. Any other questions for members regarding House File 81? Representative Norris, any closing comments, sir?
I believe we've covered it, as far as I can tell, and I appreciate your willingness to listen.
And this is all about covering it.
And my little town of Burgess appreciates it, and we'll see what happens.
All right.
All right.
Thank you both very much.
Mr. Chair,
good day.
Covering it in aggregate.
Yes. Yes. Thank you, Mr. Corrigan. Representative Johnson, House File 497. And the chair would like to move that House File 497 be laid over for possible inclusion in the division report. Representative Johnson, welcome.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and committee. What House File 497 does is provide that taxable property at the St. Paul Airport, Holman Field, as it is known, be considered part of the tax base of the City of St. Paul, the St. Paul School District, and also eligible for contribution to the fiscal disparities pool and subject to the state general tax levy. Back in 1996, the property was detached from the city and school district tax basis, so this bill attempts to remedy that exclusion. With me today is Citizen Tom Diamond, and he will put the bill in context and explain why it's important.
a real citizen. Mr. Diamond, welcome to the committee. Thank you for coming. You. Please state your name for the record.
Tom Diamond. Get a couple of handouts for the committee. But this bill is an issue of tax fairness. This property, some of you have seen this legislation before. It came to the tax committee twice, and it was well received. And what has happened with this property is this property pays no property taxes to the city of St. Paul, no property taxes to the school district, no property taxes to fiscal disparities, and no property taxes to the state of Minnesota. This property up until 1996 paid taxes. The city of St. Paul asked for a two-year break in taxes because they thought that'd be simpler than a tax increment TIF district. And when the bill got written, it didn't clarify that it was a request for a two-year exemption. It has now gone on for 17 years, 15 years past the provision. There's 820 now, the attorney 2013, that the sheet you've got is from the county assessor. $828,000 is not being paid annually in the taxes. This obviously has an impact on fairness, but also on revenue for the various different sources. It's all of you in this room. If you've got a car and you've got a garage, you pay property taxes. Small business owners pay property taxes on buildings to house their truck or their car. And these are multi-million dollar structures to house multi-million dollar jets owned by some of the largest corporations and some of the wealthiest citizens of the state of Minnesota. And so from a tax fairness standpoint, it seems reasonable that what is fair for everybody else to pay, that they should be paying. Also, if you know, of the reliever airports in the metropolitan area, if you take Fleming Field, Lake Elmo, Anoka, Crystal, Flying Cloud, all the users there, all the hangars there pay property taxes. So this is the exemption to that rule. The City of St. Paul, the City Council, is unanimously in support of seeing this repealed. And so I think that certainly take any questions, but that's the background of this legislation.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Diamond. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify regarding House File 497? Ms. Haas, good afternoon. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Nancy Haas. I'm with Messerly and Kramer here today on behalf of the tenants at Holman Field. And they're here to, and what I'd like to do on their behalf is express their concerns related to this legislation. Representative Mariani, one of the co-authors, was the original author of the bill that provided the tax relief back in 1996. And just for some context for that, at that time, the St. Paul Airport was underutilized and struggling. It was imperative to make the airport economically viable, an economically viable enterprise that would create jobs, promote growth, and in the community, and relieve some of the congestion problems at the international airport. The intent of the tax relief was to level the playing field, if you will, with the international airport, as they were already detached from the city and the school district taxes, and creating a competitive advantage when attracting new business to St. Paul Holman Field. In exchange for the exemption, the tenants at St. Paul Airport agreed to make annual payments for police and fire protection, increase the total market value of the airport property by at least 20% within 5 years, and work with local students to provide mentoring and promote careers in aviation. This proposal was brought forward with the support of the city, the school district, and the business community. It has been an asset to the international airport so that smaller aircraft can be moved over to Holman Field, thereby increasing their productivity. Some 17 years later, the 1996 legislation has been and continues to be a resounding success. There are over 300 people employed at the airport. The local area has enjoyed a substantial impact on business activities, including car rentals, local restaurants, and hotels. It is estimated that the economic benefit of the airport to the surrounding community has grown to over $112 million annually. In regards to the total market value of the airport property, there was a 200% increase in the value as of 2001, the 5-year mark, and a total increase of $21 million in total in value since 1996, far exceeding the objective of the original agreement. The St. Paul Tenants have also clearly met the commitment to promote education and mentoring. Signature Flight Support, for example, has an employee that spends a significant time devoted to this mission and has formed a partnership with Farnsworth Aerospace, an aviation-focused elementary school on St. Paul's east side. She provides tours, donates money, books, and pilot supplies. Farnsworth has been so successful, they are currently making plans to expand their program. On a more personal level, the general manager of Signature Flight Support, Clint Kummer, has been involved with an organization called ACE Camp for several years. This is a joint venture with the FAA, DOT, and several local aviation companies to promote week-long summer camps for high school students to introduce them to various aviation-related careers. Of course, the tenants have also kept their commitment to pay annually to the City of St. Paul for police and fire. In addition, the tenants shared in the financial sponsorship of purchasing a fire truck for the City of St. Paul. As you can see from these few examples, the tax relief provided in 1996 truly has been a win-win for the tenants and the community. The current bill before you changing the status is of great concern to the tenants. If soaring fuel prices continue, along with the additional taxes and the competitive advantage of MSP, who will again enjoy that status, it will endanger the prosperity and future of the business at the St. Paul Airport. Some may have characterized the current taxes exemption as a loophole, but Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, the businesses at the St. Paul Downtown Airport strongly disagree. They believe the current tax policy is necessary for the survival of our airport and has clearly been mutually beneficial to the city, the school district, and the surrounding community. Thank you for allowing me to testify. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Haas. Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I had a question of the previous testifier.
Mr. Diamond, if you'd please return to the table.
And the question, what is the status of Twin City International Airport? And the reason that I asked the question a number of years ago when I chaired the Education Committee, we had a proposal in conference committee that properties be subject to tax to pay for all-day kindergarten in certain school districts that had high incidences of free and reduced lunch and that kind of thing. But I remember all that discussion. And has that changed at Twin City International Airport, or are some of those properties still tax exempt?
Mr. Diamond.
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, that is a really unique case over there. It is not an example. One, it's not a reliever airport just for the class, but also it is a very unique case and why that is. And I'm not arguing whether it should be taxed or not, but to put it in context, that was federal property when that was established. That was part of the old fort. So that property never was and still is not in a city within the boundaries of a city. There's been some land that's been added and annexed into it, but the airport itself is not within any the boundary of the city. It is not within any school district. There are no people living within that specific exemption because it grandfathers back to that federal status. So there are no residents there, there's no school district, there is no municipality involved. That's why it does not pay into a school district, does not pay into a municipality, and has that unique status. They provide all their fire protection, they provide their own services. And again, not arguing, but that's why it's got a very unique status, unlike the reliever airports, which are within cities that provide services to them. And that's the difference between the two.
And Mr. Representative Carlson.
My recollection was that I think it was the buildings that was going to be taxed, not the land, but like hangars and that kind of thing. But
Mr. Diamond,
under that
Mr.
proposal.
Chair, Representative Carlson, yes, I should be a bit clearer about this. This has nothing to do with the public facilities. The land, the land actually is owned, most of it, by the City of St. Paul in this case, or the public facilities, the tower, or any of that. It has to do with privately owned property, buildings that are owned or operated by private entities, just for those private structures is what it's involved with.
And Mr.
Representative Carlson.
Chairman, what I'm referring to there, Mr. Chairman, were I think the buildings that were being talked about at the time, and I'm a little bit vague because it was not my bill that was in the conference committee, sure. But I think they were all buildings, or most of them were owned by Northwest Airlines at the time. And obviously there it never did happen. There was some resistance to that happening at the time. But I was just curious, because I thought you referenced that all airports, but you were talking reliever airports then.
Mr. Diamond.
Representative Carl, yes. The differentiation is the reliever airports versus MSP. And again, the reason being is that they have all historically always paid, including Holman, have paid that tax until this exemption, which was asked for as only a two-year exemption instead of a TIF district. And admittedly, there is a financial benefit, and it is a great for a business or an individual not to have to pay any taxes. But the catch is, who pays for the commons then? And that's what why the city of St. Paul, as I say, unanimously, one, did not support anything more than a two-year provision in the first place, but has unanimously supported that this provision be discontinued.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Faust.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple of questions for the other testifier, Ms. Haas. Thank you. The first question is, Tom Diamond mentioned that when this system was originally set up, the agreement was for 2 years. Do you dispute that at all, or is that true?
Ms. Haas.
Mr. Chair and Representative Faust, you know, I looked at that history a long time ago, and what my recollection was, that I think what his reference was is to an original agreement that was never introduced into law. The actual language that ended up being introduced had a five-year time period to achieve some measures. And those measures that I talked about had to do with, number one, making the payment in lieu of taxes.
Yeah.
The getting the market value of the property up to at least 20% within 5 years, and then working with local students. So that's what ended up in the bill that passed in 1996.
Okay.
And those are the measures that we met.
Representative Faust.
Okay, thank you very much. The second question, how much have the tenants paid to the firefighter and police for that protection, that payment that you just mentioned? How much has that been on an annual basis?
Ms. Haas.
Mr. Chair and Representative Faust, it's been some time since I looked at that. I'd be happy to get that information to you. I think it's about $100,000 maybe a year.
How much?
$100,000, but I'm just going on my memory. Maybe Mr. Diamond.
Mr. Faust, or Representative Faust, if you wait 1 second. Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chair, Representative Faust, I just checked with St. Paul today, and the payment for last year was $116,000, and they said it's been in that general neighborhood for the last few years.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just for this, for the handout purposes here that we're looking at, so it's $116,000 that they're paying for police and fire. And according, this is the document you passed out, right, Mr. Diamond?
Yes.
So the $156,000 in, and I'm using your terminology, not mine here, city benefit, so this change would net the city an extra $40,000 then?
Mr. Diamond.
Chair, Representative Garofalo, first of all, that has not been the percentage that they have been paying. They've been paying roughly about 10%. They're paying a little more now, but it's varied. It's not a set amount. But yes, what this is mainly about is tax fairness. Obviously, this is important of dollars and cents, but this is tax fairness. If other homeowners, small business operators are paying taxes, they believe that everybody should pay the same taxes. And I could also provide, if you want to make a copy, I've only got one copy, but I've got a copy of the City Council resolution, which limits it to sunsetting on December 31st, 1998, for your record.
Representative Garofalo.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Diamond, so the effect of this bill, should it be put into law, would be to remove $116,000 in funding for police and fire and put $156,000 into the St. Paul General Fund. Is that correct?
Mr. Diamond.
Yes. There would be additional funds for the city, and then there would be also to the school district fiscal disparities and to the state pool.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Garofalo.
So, but just so I understand the city portion of it, I want to come back to these questions first. But from the city's perspective, the first thing that would happen is, I'm assuming these payments in lieu of taxes that are being given for police and fire, there would be no legal obligation for them to require that anymore. I would defer to staff. Is that a correct statement, or Mr. Diamond?
Mr. Hines,
still have to pay those.
Let's go to staff first, and then
Mr. Chair. I'm sure that if they were back, if this bill was enacted, that those in lieu payments would go away. Yeah.
So, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Diamond,
Mr. Graffler, so Representative Graffler, excuse me.
Problems with the misters and the representatives today. Huh?
It's a little tricky.
So, but from the city portion of things, though, the first thing that would happen is we would defund the money going directly to police and fire, can't be used for anything else, and then we'd be giving the city $156,000 in the hopes that they would fund police and fire.
Mr. Diamond.
Mr. Chair, Representative Garofalo, the city would have more revenue to fund police and fire than they would today with this plan.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chairman and
Representative Garofalo.
So let's get to that issue. So my understanding is the way school districts, cities and counties levy is they levy a dollar amount, and then that allocation of the dollars is done on a classification rate. Am I mistaken in that?
Well, why don't you, I assume that was more rhetorical.
No, I'm seriously asking. Right. St. Paul levy things in a different way than every other municipality?
Mr. Hines?
Mr. Chair, Representative Garofalo, you're correct, although we have no way of knowing if St. Paul had more tax base, they might choose to levy more. But they certainly name a levy, and that gets spread, as you said.
So, Mr. Chairman and Mr.
Representative Garofalo.
So the assumption then is, given this additional tax capacity, the city of St. Paul and the St. Paul School District would raise taxes.
Mr. Diamond?
Mr. Chair, Representative Garofalo, as you know, on all levels of taxation, you have a choice of raising the levy to raise taxes, or if you increase the tax base, you don't have to you raise the levy, but you don't raise the taxes on other parties because it's spread out over a wider base. So you can charge everybody the same taxes that they are charged this year, next year, but you do it over a broader base so you can get the additional money.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Cross.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Diamond, then that would not result in any additional dollars to school districts nor municipalities if they have the same dollar amount. What you're doing?
No.
Yes. What you're proposing is that you expand the tax base and keep a levy the same. So that would mean that an average business would get, and every property owner would get a slight reduction in their levy.
Mr. Diamond?
Mr. Representative Graffler, no, what I'm saying is the way the tax law is allowed, local government units can decide which way they want to go with the levy. They can either they have additional tax base, they can either get additional revenue. Say, for example, you get another $50,000 in tax base that would bring you the revenue. You can either take that in the additional revenue, you can raise your levy $50,000, which doesn't affect anybody else because you're doing it over a broader tax base, or you can use it to lower everybody's tax because you have a wider tax base. So you can do it either choice. That's the local unit of government's
right,
choice to do it.
So
Representative Garofalo.
Mr. Diamond, this gets back to my original question then. My point is that we are assuming, in order for, because I'm reading your letter here, that with additional funds then, the city would have to increase their levy. In order for this to not be, because assuming in a parallel universe they keep the levy the same,
right,
all that's just distributed. So the act of us passing this bill does not provide one penny of extra assistance to a city. It doesn't provide one more dollar for the classroom or school construction. These local decisions are still going to be based off what the levy is. Now, you can make the argument that if they decide to raise taxes, a smaller percentage of that tax increase is going to be distributed to those jurisdictions in the taxing unit. But in terms of this bill as a mechanism for increasing revenue for local units of government or schools, that's not correct.
Mr. Dunn.
Mr. Chair, Representative Garofalo. Yes, you're correct that the local units of government can choose with this authority either to lower either one of two things. They can either lower everybody's taxes, or they can keep everybody's taxes the same, but with a larger base, tax base, they can increase the revenue to the city. It's either choice, but that you're correct. It's their choice to make that decision.
Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Wanted to know a little more about the revenue from landings and so on. Because if what we do here, it looks like there's a number of companies that rent a lot of bays. And, right, so this is for really more transient clients that come and land at the airport. But I'm just curious, so if they decide that somehow this isn't an attractive place anymore to land, what happens, say, that half of these people decide to go somewhere else?
Representative Runbeck, who are you addressed? Just to clarify.
Maybe Mr. Diamond.
Mr. Diamond.
Mr. Chair, Representative Runbeck, the airport is has a runway length that is attractive for corporate jets. The way that the structure was set up is there were supposed to be, and get me off if I'm giving you too much information, but there were supposed to be three intermediate reliever airports in the system. The legislature, in its wisdom, has chosen to rule out two of those airports from that. So this is the only airport of the reliever that handles the larger of the corporate jets. And so that's what the market that it serves today. And so there is little reason to believe that that they would go elsewhere, because they generally, many of the airplanes really cannot land at the other reliever airports.
Representative Runbeck.
So they're captive. Mr. Chair, they're captive. There's really nothing that they're going to do. It just seems, well, okay. Okay.
All right. Any other questions from members?
Thank you, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you both. Representative Johnson, any closing comments?
Thank you for the committee's time, and no other closing comments. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. With that, the Chair renews his motion that House File 497 be held over for possible inclusion in the division report. With that, ladies and gentlemen, we are adjourned. Thank you very much.